Welcome to the Westminster Deep Dive Podcast. We've designed this as a resource to help you metabolize and integrate Sunday's sermon and the scriptures we've explored into your everyday lives. As we journey through the book of Philippians during Lent, our prayer is that we'll make more space for the Holy Spirit to be able to speak, to help us slow down and be formed more deeply and be more available for the joy that God wants to offer. This is an AI-generated podcast. We've taken the sermon and the scriptures and then given it questions that we're reflecting on as we endeavor to be more deeply formed. I hope you enjoy it. We will discuss this around tables at Westminster Wednesdays in this season. So thank you for listening.
Okay, let's unpack this right at the start. You know that specific heavy feeling that hits you around, say, 2 p.m. on a Tuesday?
Oh, yeah. I know it well.
It's not just that you're tired from a lack of sleep. It's deeper than that.
Yeah.
It's the weight of the calendar. It's the mental load of maintaining your brand, you know, personally, professionally, socially, especially in a city like Charlotte that just never really slows down.
Absolutely. It is the modern condition. I mean, we usually just call it burnout or, well, just life.
Right.
But I think the sources we're looking at today would identify it as something much more spiritual. They'd call it empty glory.
Empty glory.
Yeah, it's the sheer exhaustion of trying to be the CEO of your own universe.
CEO of your own universe. That is a terrifying job description when you say it out loud.
It really is.
And that is exactly where we are starting today. Welcome to the Deep Dives. We are continuing our journey through the season of Lent, and specifically, we are dissecting a very old text to answer a very modern problem.
Right, Philippians chapter 2.
Exactly. How do we find actual durable joy when we are essentially running on fumes?
And to get there, we are synthesizing a really fascinating stack of sources today.
We've got a lot of good stuff.
We really do. We have a sermon delivered just this week by Reverend Owen Stepp from Westminster Presbyterian, combined with some heavy theological artillery.
Yeah, commentaries from Warren Wiersbe.
Right, the philosophical writings of Dallas Willard, and of course, a healthy dose of C.S. Lewis.
Always need some C.S. Lewis.
Yeah.
So we are zeroing in on verses 12 through 18 today. And I want to set the stakes right up front for you listening. This isn't just a nice reflection on being happy.
No, not at all.
The mission of this deep dive is to resolve a massive contradiction that I think messes with a lot of people's heads.
It really is the central tension of the entire spiritual life.
Right. The big question is, who is actually doing the work?
Yeah.
Like, if I want to be a better person or a holier person or just, frankly, a less angry person, is that on me?
Right. Do you have to white-knuckle your way to perfection?
Exactly. Or am I supposed to just, you know, let go and let God and just wait for a lightning bolt to strike me with infinite patience?
It's the classic debate. Is it all God or is it all us? And the answer Paul gives in this letter to the Philippians is surprisingly complex.
It's a paradox.
It is a paradox.
But before we try to untangle that, give us the context. Paul isn't writing this from a beach resort somewhere, right?
Far from it. He is actually in a Roman prison writing to the church in Philippi. And on the surface, this is a good group of people.
Okay.
But underneath, there are cracks. They have internal friction. They're bickering. And they're living in what Paul calls a warped and crooked generation.
Which honestly feels like he could be tweeting that about 2026.
It really resonates, doesn't it? He's writing to people living in a chaotic, morally confusing world, trying to figure out how to just keep their heads above water.
Yeah.
And in verse 12, he drops this command that, at first glance, sounds incredibly stressful.
Okay, let's read it. This is segment one, the paradox. Paul writes, "Continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose."
There it is.
Okay, stop right there. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. That does not sound like grace to me.
No, it doesn't.
That sounds like a performance review where my job is literally on the line. It sounds like you better get this right or else.
It certainly sounds that way to modern ears. I mean, we hear the word fear and we immediately think terror.
Right. We think God is standing over us with a clipboard.
Exactly. Checking off all our mistakes. But the sources point out that the meaning here isn't about being scared of punishment at all.
What is it then?
It's about awe. It's that trembling you feel when you're in the presence of something massive and powerful.
Oh, like standing on the edge of a cliff. or seeing a massive storm roll in.
Exactly. You aren't afraid the storm is personally attacking you, but you're trembling because you realize how small you are and how big it is.
That makes sense.
That's the fear. But the real confusion usually comes from the first part. Work out your salvation.
Right. Because if salvation is supposed to be a free gift, why am I working for it? That feels like I'm paying for my own birthday present.
Ah, but look closely at the prepositions. Paul doesn't say work for your salvation.
He says work out.
He says work out your salvation. This is where Warren Wiersbe gives us this brilliant distinction that just clears up the fog immediately.
Oh, the ins and outs.
Yes. He says the Christian life isn't a series of ups and downs. It's a series of ins and outs.
Break that down for us. Ins and outs.
Okay. So the in is God's part. That is verse 13. For it is God who works in you.
Okay.
That is the internal transformation. That's the engine. You cannot forgive your own sins. You cannot regenerate your own heart. That is entirely 100% God's work of grace.
Okay, so the battery is installed by God. The power source is entirely His.
Yes. But the out is our part. To work out means to bring something to completion. It means taking that internal reality, that nuclear reactor God put inside you, and conducting that energy out into your actual life, into your fingertips, your speech, your calendar.
So it's almost like God provides the seed, but I have to till the soil.
Or think of it like a mine. The gold is already in the mountain. That's God's gift.
Okay.
Working it out is the labor of mining that gold and bringing it to the surface where it actually has value. It's not about earning the gold. It's about accessing it and using it.
That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
But practically speaking, what does that look like? Because mining sounds like a lot of hard labor.
It is labor. Dallas Willard has this definition of discipleship that really grounds this concept. He says a disciple is someone who seriously intends to become like Jesus from the inside out.
Seriously intend? I like that phrasing.
Yeah.
It implies it's not accidental. You don't just wake up one day and accidentally become a saint.
Right. You don't drift into holiness. And Willard goes on to say that a disciple systematically and progressively rearranges their affairs to that end.
Rearranges their affairs. See, that hits home. That sounds like checking my bank statement.
Exactly.
That sounds like looking at my Google Calendar and realizing I have zero margin for kindness because I am booked solid from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m.
Precisely. That is the work. God doesn't bypass our agency. He doesn't turn us into robots that are automatically nice to people.
Right.
We have to make the conscious choice to rearrange our lives, to change our habits or spending our time, to let that internal work of God actually flow out.
So if I'm understanding this right, the answer to the big question, who does the work, is yes.
Basically, yes. We are co-laborers. God works in, we work it out.
Okay, so if I accept that I have to rearrange my affairs to let this joy out, what is the biggest obstacle?
Mm-hmm.
Because Paul pivots immediately to something very specific. And I have to say, felt like a personal attack when I read it.
You're talking about verse 14.
Do everything without grumbling or arguing.
The ultimate joy killer.
I mean, come on. Everything. Can't I grumble just a little bit about traffic on I-77? Or the price of eggs? Or the fact that the barista put dairy in my oat milk latte?
Paul seems to think not. And it's comforting, in a weird way, to know that human nature really hasn't changed at all.
Right.
Paul had to write this 2,000 years ago because the Philippians were grumbling then, just like we grumble now in the break room, on social media, or at the dinner table.
Well, why is it such a big deal? I mean, we tend to think of grumbling as a pretty minor vice. It's not murder. It's not adultery. It's just venting. It almost feels necessary for survival.
We call it venting because that makes it sound therapeutic, like, oh, I'm just letting off steam.
Exactly.
But the sources for this deep dive take a much darker view of it. They look at Saint Benedict, the father of Western monasticism.
Oh, the monk rules. This was honestly my favorite part of the research.
Benedict took grumbling incredibly seriously. In his community, it wasn't just considered rude. It was a serious offense against the very structure of life together. And he didn't just ban speaking it out loud. He banned grumbling in the heart.
Which is an incredibly high bar. You can't even think it.
Because God sees the heart. But my absolute favorite part of the research was the penalty for being a persistent grumbler in the monastery.
Yes, the stout monks.
Yes. If a monk wouldn't stop complaining, the rule suggested the abbot send two stout monks to explain the matter to him.
I love that euphemism, explain the matter.
Right.
I'm just picturing two huge bouncers in burlap robes showing up at your cell door like, Brother, we need to have a little chat about your attitude.
It's funny, but it really underscores the point. They believed grumbling was deeply contagious. It poisons the entire community.
Yeah.
And C.S. Lewis takes it even further. He has this chilling line in The Great Divorce. He says, "Hell begins with a grumbling mood."
Whoa, hell. That escalated quickly.
He argues that grumbling starts as just a mood, then it becomes a habit, and eventually it becomes your entire identity.
So you just become the grumble.
Exactly. You cease to be a person. You just become a grumble. And the reason it's so dangerous, and this connects right back to our modern exhaustion, is that grumbling positions us as the judge.
The judge of what?
Of everything.
Yeah.
When I grumble, I am essentially saying, I know exactly how the world should run.
Right.
That driver should be faster. This weather should be cooler. You should be more competent. I am placing myself right in the seat of God.
That actually explains the exhaustion perfectly. If I have to be the general manager of the universe and critique everyone's performance all day long, no wonder I'm so tired.
Exactly. And think about our culture right now. We live in a review economy.
Oh, yeah.
You buy a pair of socks, you get an email. How did we do? Rate us. You eat a sandwich. Rate your driver. We are actively trained to look for flaws. We are trained to be critics.
So we're constantly scanning the horizon for what's wrong.
And that completely destroys communion. You cannot have a genuine relationship with someone if you are constantly judging them.
You can't.
You can't have unity in a church or a family or an office if everyone is keeping a scorecard of grievances.
So if grumbling is the poison, what's the antidote? Because just telling someone to stop it is a lot easier said than done.
The antidote is humility. It's officially resigning from your position as judge of the universe. It's realizing, hey, I am not the center of the story.
Which leads us directly to the next image Paul uses. And I'll be honest, this one is even harder for a modern person to swallow than the no grumbling rule.
We're moving to verse 17.
Right. Paul writes, "But even if I am being poured out like a drink offering on the sacrifice and service of your coming to faith, I am glad and rejoice with all of you."
Poured out like a drink offering. It's such a powerful image.
It is, but I think we need to decode it a bit. What exactly is a drink offering to a first century listener?
So for the Roman converts in Philippi, this would immediately trigger an image of a pagan feast. At the end of a meal, or right before a sacrifice, the priest would take a cup of wine, very expensive, valuable wine, and pour it straight onto the ground or onto the altar.
So it's a total waste.
Economically speaking, yes. It's gone. You can't drink it. You can't sell it. It is completely spent for the deity.
And for the Jewish believers.
They'd think of the temple sacrifices where wine was poured out right alongside the lamb.
But Paul is applying this image to himself.
Right. He's saying, my life is the wine. He is sitting in a prison cell, likely facing execution, and he views his life not as something being stolen from him, but as something he is intentionally pouring out.
See, this is exactly where I get stuck. And I think a lot of you listening might too. We hear pour yourself out, and we instantly hear burnout. We hear let people take advantage of you. We hear have absolutely no boundaries. Isn't there a massive danger in that?
That is a very valid fear. Mm-hmm. We protect ourselves because we think if I pour myself out, I'll be empty. I'll be completely used up. I won't have anything left for me.
Exactly. You can't pour from an empty cup.
Right.
That's the modern slogan.
It is. And there is definitely truth to self-care, obviously. But the gospel offers a completely counterintuitive truth here. It says that a life lived entirely for itself, a life where you hoard your energy, your time, your status, your cup, that life actually shrinks.
It becomes small.
It becomes small and sour.
There's a quote in the source material from Oswald Chambers, well, via Jamie Peckling, that really struck a pin in this idea. He said, "You can't drink a grape."
It's such a simple, vivid image. A grape is round. It's completely self-contained. It has a skin protecting it. It's safe.
Right.
But as long as it stays a grape, it can't bring joy. It can never be wine.
It has to be crushed.
It has to be crushed.
Yeah.
The skin has to break. That is the paradox of joy. Joy isn't found in preservation. It's found in expenditure. It's found in being used for a purpose much higher than yourself.
To illustrate this, Reverend Stepp shared a story from The Hiding Place by Corey Ten Boom. And I have to say, if you've heard this story before, in this context, it hits so much harder.
It's a heavy story, but it perfectly captures this vast difference between hoarding your life and pouring it out.
So to set the scene for you guys, it's World War II.
Yeah.
The Ten Boom family is in Harlem hiding Jews from the Nazis.
Right. And the danger is escalating daily. They desperately need to find a safe house for a Jewish mother and her baby. It's a critical situation.
Okay.
So a local pastor comes to their watch shop. Now, this is a man of God, a recognized leader in the community. Corey's father, Casper Ten Boom, asks him, "Will you take this mother and child into your home?"
And the pastor says no.
He says no. But listen to his specific reason. He says, no, we could lose our lives for that Jewish child.
He was afraid.
He was afraid. He was protecting his grave. He was hoarding his safety. And logically speaking, he was completely right. The danger was incredibly real.
But then the response from Casper Ten Boom.
Casper, who is an old man at this point, takes the baby into his arms. He looks at the child. Then he looks right at the pastor. And he says, "You say we could lose our lives for this child. I would consider that the greatest honor that could ever come to my family."
A greatest honor.
That is the shift. The pastor saw a loss to be avoided. Casper saw an opportunity to be poured out. He saw that the whole purpose of his life wasn't to stay safe. It was to spend himself for others.
And we know the history. Casper Ten Boom was arrested shortly after that.
He was.
He died in captivity. He literally lost his life.
He did. He was crushed. But because he was crushed, look at the wine that was produced. The story of the Ten Boom family has nourished millions of people for decades now.
Wow.
Their drink offering is still bringing joy and hope to the world. And the pastor who stayed safe, we don't even know his name.
That is haunting. But it's also deeply inspiring. It reframes the work we talked about earlier. Rearranging our affairs isn't just about harsh discipline. It's about positioning ourselves so we actually can be poured out.
Exactly. Deep joy is never found in what we keep. It is always found in what we give.
So let's bring this plane down to the runway. Most of us aren't hiding refugees in our attics in Charlotte. But we are battling that empty glory. The constant need to look successful, the need to win the argument, the need to protect our carefully curated image.
The vain conceit, as Paul calls it.
So how do we actually apply this today? The sources gave us a formula that, frankly, sounds like something from a flannel graph in Sunday school.
It really does.
But they claim it works.
It's the J-O-Y acronym.
J-O-Y. Break it down for us.
Jesus. Others. Yourself.
It sounds almost too simplistic.
It is simplistic, but it's also incredibly profound because it's an ordering of loves. The real source of our exhaustion is usually that we have flipped the order entirely.
Right.
We start with why yourself, my needs, my image, my feelings. Then maybe others, if they happen to fit perfectly in my schedule, and Jesus gets whatever scraps are left over.
And that order YOJ leads directly to anxiety.
It leads to constant exhausting maintenance. But if you flip it back, Jesus first as the source, others second as the channel, yourself third as the vessel, the pressure just comes off.
I think the key distinction the source has made here is crucial. Putting yourself last doesn't mean self-hatred.
Right. That's a huge misconception.
Mm-hmm.
Humility isn't thinking less of yourself, like, oh, I'm garbage, I don't matter. Humility is thinking of yourself less.
It's simply sweeping the big eye out of the center of the room.
Exactly. You stop staring at yourself in the mirror all day. You look out the window instead.
So to help us do that, to stop staring in the mirror, we have a specific practice for this deep dive. Because we always want to move from theory to action.
Right. This week, it is the practice of emptying. And we're going to use journaling to do it.
Okay. I'm listening. What's the prompt?
This comes from the idea that Lent, and really the whole Christian life, is about spring cleaning the soul. N.T. Wright talks about this. You have to clear out the junk to make room for the grace.
Okay.
So find 2 minutes of silence. Just 2 minutes.
Even I could do 2 minutes.
And write down the answer to 2 specific questions. Question 1, what do you long to release?
What does that mean, practically speaking?
It means, what is the heavy thing you're dragging around? Maybe it's the need to be right in a recurring argument with your spouse. Maybe it's the anxiety about your quarterly numbers. Maybe it's the mask you wear so people think you're perfectly successful. Name it. Write it down. I want to release the need to impress my boss.
And question 2.
Question 2. What do you long for God to give you to fill that space?
So if I release anxiety, I might ask for peace.
Or if you release the need to be right, which is judgment, you might ask for curiosity. It's a trade. You pour out the vinegar so God can pour in the wine.
I love that.
Yeah.
It turns the high theology into a transaction we can actually do on a Tuesday afternoon.
It makes it incredibly concrete.
This has been a really rich discussion. We've covered a ton of ground today.
We really have. We started with the paradox. It is God who works in, but we must work it out. It's a true partnership.
We looked at the ultimate joy killer, grumbling. the stout monks remind us that complaining poisons the community and positions us as the judge of the universe, which is a job we are definitively not qualified for.
And we looked at the secret to joy, being poured out. Like the grape, like Casper 10 Boom, it is scary to break the skin, but that is the only way to become wine.
And finally, the practice.
Yeah.
Empty and at the big. So there is room for J-O-Y Jesus, others, yourself.
Now, if this conversation has sparked something in you, if you're realizing, wow, I have a lot of grumbling in my heart, or I don't actually know how to pour myself out, don't just sit with that alone.
Absolutely not. We have a place to work this out together. Westminster Wednesday is happening this week.
It's the perfect environment to test these ideas out. Dinner is at 5:30 p.m. Come hungry.
And the discussion starts around the tables at 6:15 p.m. The goal isn't to hear another lecture. It's to sit with your neighbors and say, okay, this grumbling thing, I really struggle with that.
That vulnerability, that's the working it out part. That's where the real growth happens.
5:30 p.m. for dinner, 6:15 p.m. for discussion. We would love to see you there.
Before we sign off, though, I want to leave you with one final thought. It's a bit of a provocation to take with you into your week.
Let's hear it.
It connects back to that deep exhaustion we started with. It's the difference between entitlement and grace.
Entitlement versus grace.
Think about it. If you wake up every morning believing the world owes you happiness, that you are entitled to a smooth commute, a polite barista, and a promotion, then you can never be truly grateful.
Because every good thing is just a payment you were already expecting.
Exactly. If I owe you $10 and I give it to you, you don't say thank you. You say, it's about time.
Right.
You're just settling a debt. Entitlement kills joy because it makes absolutely everything a transaction.
But the flip side.
If you view everything as a gift of grace you didn't earn and don't deserve, then joy becomes mathematically inevitable.
Wow.
Because every breath, every hot cup of coffee, every moment of friendship, it's all a bonus. It's all extra.
That changes everything.
So the question for you listening is this. Are you walking through your day waiting for a payment? Or are you receiving a gift?
Something to chew on as you check your to-do list today. Deepening joy might just be a shift in perspective away. Thanks for diving in with us.
See you Wednesday.